listening. The date is Monday the 13th of March and you are listening to Bee Radio. I'm Maddie.
And I'm Charlie.
And we are your hosts for this news broadcast.
Today, we'll be taking you through some of the top local, national and international news articles, as well as a deeper dive into some of the biggest stories in the media at the moment.
Last night saw the return of the Oscars with their 95th award ceremony taking place in Los Angeles, hosted for the third year in a row by Jimmy Kimmel. Everything Everywhere All at Once swept up an amazing 7 awards, including Best Picture, Director, Original Screenplay, and 3 out of 4 acting categories. This makes it the most awarded Best Picture film since Slumdog Millionaire.
And yesterday afternoon in the Premier League, Arsenal beat Fulham 3-0 in a crucial clash to keep their 5-point gap at the top of the table intact after Manchester City's win on Saturday, which put the pressure on them yet again to get 3 points.
England faced a massive loss of 53-10 in the Six Nations match against France at the weekend, leaving them in fourth place on the table.
And a man in his 50s has been confirmed dead after a lorry crashed into a row of houses after coming off the road in Purfleet, Essex on Friday. Essex police say that no one else was injured and no other vehicles were involved.
More to come on local and national news in a moment.
So, into local news, the old Reading jail, famous for holding Oscar Wilde in the 19th century, has been grabbing local headlines this week. The future of the derelict Reading jail has been discussed in council meetings after almost a decade after the Ministry of Justice closed the prison in 2014. The prison site has been up for sale since 2019, and many local politicians and artists have been keen to turn it into a cultural hub or art gallery. Even famous street artist Banksy, who has one of his famous paintings on the side of the prison wall, has offered to provide funding. I think this recent initiative is great and something positive for the local people in Reading to look forward to. Turning this old building with such negative past into something positive for all the community to share would be amazing, especially seeing as it has been up for sale since 2019 with no preferred bidders being taken. It just seems to make sense and be a win-win for the government and the community. And Reading MPs Matt Rodder and Alok Sharma recently had a meeting with the new prison minister, and they are positive and confident that this and future meetings will be enough to persuade the government in allowing the plan to go forward. So what do you think about this?
I think it seems like a really, really good idea. Obviously, there are a few celebrities from Reading. I know Kate Winslet has actually been pretty open in her support of turning the prison into a sort of cultural hub or art gallery, like you said. But I think it's really great. I mean, it would definitely put Reading on the map a bit more. And being so close to London, it wouldn't be too far for tourists to travel out. I know that Oscar Wilde's home in Dublin is really, really popular for tourists that visit Dublin. And so I think, you know, being a 20-minute train ride from London, it would be really, really great to have a bit more of a touristy environment in Reading, bring a bit more money, and I'm sure for local businesses as well, it would be a really winning situation for them. So, yeah, I mean, I don't see any problems with it. I think it sounds like a really, really good idea.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's great for tourism and the people in the local area, for sure. Something for them to really look forward to. And I feel like, seeing as it has been shut since 2014, why not make it into something positive for all the community to share?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's been empty for long enough.
Exactly, for sure.
So, looking more at national news, the recent Brit Awards were faced with heavy criticism after it was announced that the categories of Best Male Artist and Best Female Artist were to be combined in order to be more inclusive for non-binary artists, for example, Sam Smith. Further outrage was caused, though, when it was announced that no women were nominated in this new Artist of the Year category, despite there being many female artists that had released music in the past year. Winner of the award, Harry Styles, paid homage to these women in his acceptance speech by thanking, first of all, his old One Direction band members and stating that he was very aware of his privilege up here tonight. So this award is for Rina, Charlie, Florence, Mabel and Becky, the female artists that potentially should have been nominated. This has been majorly controversial, as despite them claiming that the merging of the two categories was for inclusivity of all, in fact only men were nominated. Out of 13 awards, only 5 of the awards were won by women, with multiple categories including no female nominees. Sam Smith also headlined many papers with his controversial performance of his song Unholy, which sparked over 100 Ofcom complaints, according to the broadcasting regulator.
And I agree overall. I think it's a shame that we haven't seen any female artists nominated for this year's Best Artist. It seems very unfair and unrepresentative of the music industry, especially as there was an increase in the number of female artists and groups. but many have come out in the media and just said that they are just happy about the changes, which are believed to have come at the right time with pure intentions of inclusivity. And I think it could just be a coincidence that only men were nominated this year. And I believe as the years go on with the inclusion of genderless awards, we will see more representation for not only women, but for minority groups in society. Do you think this will be the case?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think, especially after the backlash faced this year, I think that they'll definitely be more considerate in the future to really take into account female artists and non-binary artists, because, yeah, okay, no women were nominated, but actually it was only men that were nominated. You know, there weren't any non-binary artists nominated. So I think that in order for them to call themselves inclusive, they need to actually use this combination of the categories to include people other than just men. But like you said, I mean, it potentially was just a coincidence, and all of the artists nominated, you know, were deserving of the award. So I think that the fact that it's limited to only 5 nominees is perhaps part of the reason for it. But yeah, like you said, I think definitely going on, this will be a good move, and I think definitely more inclusive for everyone.
Yeah, I definitely think that as the years go by with the genderless awards, we will see better inclusivity from the Brits Awards. And I also think it's great that Harry Styles came out and applauded or spoke about the women that he thought deserved the nomination in his speech. I think it's great for him to use that stage to give them the attention that they clearly didn't get that evening. So yeah,
definitely. I think it's really important to have a place of privilege to use that platform to make sure that they include people that don't necessarily have the same privileges as them.
Yeah, exactly. And further controversy from the Brits, which come from the Sam Smith performance, which you just spoke about. The performance of his new popular song, Unholy, which has raised a few questions, to say the least. He has been criticised for the performance being too sexual and demonic. And like you said, it's sparked over 100 Ofcom complaints, which is crazy, to say the least. And I think people are concerned because Sam Smith has such a mainstream following and his music is everywhere. Everyone knows Sam Smith. And there is a worry that he has overdone it with a performance that is degrading himself, but potentially harmful to others. And also, Sam is quite known to appeal to younger demographics, so what do you think of the situation as a whole?
Yeah, I mean, I can totally understand people's upset, if you will. I think that because there is obviously the religion aspect brought into it, it could be disrespectful, which is completely understandable. I do think, however, you have to sort of take a bit of responsibility. You know, if you have your children watching things like this, the Brit Awards was on late at night on a Saturday, so you know, it's not as if it was daytime television that your children would be watching. You know, it's quite easy to shield them from that if you do so. I think that, you know, over the past 5 years especially, the way that people express themselves has really, really become different for everyone, and for some people maybe controversial. But I do think that, you know, if you really aren't interested in it and you don't like it, then there is just always the option to not watch.
That is true. But I do think that the criticism is a bit justified in many places, because I feel like it is very overly flamboyant, very over the top. And I think that this could have a rather negative perspective or negative consequence on the way that people see the way that the people see non-binary people and non-binary issues moving forward. So do you think that this could potentially be damaging to them?
Yeah, I think it's so difficult, because obviously when you take just one person from a group of people, they can sort of give off an image of the entire group of people when that's not necessarily correct. But I also think that perhaps the trouble comes where, of course, 10 years ago, Sam Smith was known for just singing ballads, and they weren't overly flamboyant, and if you hadn't listened to them in a while, perhaps you would not be expecting the performance that was put on at the Brits. So I think some people that haven't listened to them in a while potentially have not known what was coming. But I do think that it's really good, like, you know, inclusivity of all, and it's nice to have Kim Petras was there as well, actually. So she's the first, I believe, the first trans woman to perform at the Brits, which is really, really lovely. But I think overall the performance was very flamboyant, but the message behind it, you know, that no matter your gender, it, you know, there's a place in the arts for everyone.
Yeah, and I feel that's an important point. Inclusivity is very important, and I suppose it is good to see someone that is non-binary to hold such a big stage and do the opening performance of the Brit. So there's a lot of positives that we can take out of it. And now we have an interview of a student from the University of Reading giving us their opinions on the recent Brit Awards.
Right, so I'm here with Jacob, a student from the University of Reading, who's going to answer a few questions about the recent Brit Awards and the controversial Sam Smith performance. So firstly, what do you think about the performance of the song Unholy Smith at the recent Brit Award?
Well, thanks, Charlie. I think it was very deliberately controversial to sort of, you know, provoke people and just get as much attention as possible. Particularly with the devil horns and him dressing up as a devil, I think was slightly inappropriate for sort of just a mainstream audience.
And so do you think Sam was justified to put on such a controversial performance, especially considering his demographic of listeners and the fact that he's so well known and his songs are frequently played on the radio, you know?
I think on the Brit Awards, like I said earlier, it's a sort of very mainstream audience. You have children watching it, you know, looking up to it, and you know, you have Christian people watching it as well, and him dressing up as a devil and dancing in that way, I think isn't very justified in that sort of mainstream audience. If it was a normal performance where someone paid to watch it, I think it would be completely justified. But an award ceremony where he's getting an award and it's just to the mainstream public, he could have sort of maybe not censored it, but made it a little more subtle, I think.
And what do you think this does for the outlook on how people look at the non-binary community?
I think the non-binary community, it might shed a bad light on them because it's sort of portraying them in a sort of evil, demonic way. And it would have been slightly better if they put them in a better light.
And lastly, what do you think about the new gender-neutral award categories? Do you feel this will improve inclusivity in the future for music industry?
I think it marginalises diverse by just putting people in categories. You're not on their style of performance or how good they actually are. You're saying you're separate from the rest of the other categories. So I think it doesn't make it more inclusive. It sort of makes them stick out. You should judge them on their content rather than, you know, what they are. So I think it does the exact opposite.
And thank you for that, Jacob. Thank you for your contributions.
The entries for this year's Eurovision Song Contest have been announced, with the UK entry being North London-born singer Mae Muller, with her entry titled I Wrote a Song, which is currently sitting on the iTunes chart in third place, Miley Cyrus in second, and Calvin Harris and Ellie Goulding in first place. Eurovision was won by Ukraine last year, but due to their unfortunate ongoing conflict, the UK, being the runners-up, will be hosting on their behalf. The final of the contest is set to take place on May 13th in Liverpool, with many individuals complaining about hotel prices for that weekend. We had a look ourselves, and a budget hotel near the arena that would usually be around £72 per night, but around the date of the final is £539. The bookies' favourite to win is Sweden, who have entered their 2012 winner Loreen again, with many Twitter users joking about how they have already booked their hotel in Sweden for May 2024. Spaceman singer Sam Ryder got us ever so close to the win last year by winning the jury vote, but the addition of the televoting gave Ukraine the win. Hopefully we can stay on the left side of the board this year.
Hopefully we can, but we haven't won the Eurovision contest since 1997, but I am confident this year that we can go all the way, as we were so very close last year, like you said, finishing runners-up to eventual winners. And on top of that, it's on home soil this year, and it's hosted in Liverpool, which I think is such a perfect city. It's so rich in history and culture, and music in particular, such as the Beatles, for example. But like you said, the hotels in Liverpool have skyrocketed in price. Rooms worth around £70 now being sold for upwards of £500. I mean, what a joke.
It's crazy, and it's not as if you're getting a luxury hotel either. On Twitter have been complaining about how they'd previously booked hotels before in Liverpool, just in case it was going to be in Liverpool. And when it was announced, the hotels were being cancelled. One user on Twitter said that they'd booked a room for an Airbnb, for £200, and it got cancelled. And when they looked later, the room had been moved up to £42,000 for one night.
Yeah, I mean, that is absolutely crazy. And I think reselling for events is just getting completely out of hand in recent years. And it's made going to events much less attainable for the average person, as prices for almost everything related to these events are marked up by resellers. And I feel as if the music industry and these events should be doing more to tackle these resellers so these events are accessible for all.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, I think that for a lot of people, that is actually their business, buying tickets and reselling them for crazy prices. We know that Beyonce tickets came out recently, and the markup that you see on some of these reselling sites is absolutely crazy. Harry Styles for a long time, and it's going for upwards of £20,000. Absolutely insane. And I think that there does need to be more done to stop resellers, as it really does ruin the experience. You know, a lot of people going to these events don't have the money to spend on crazy tickets like that. And when the resellers are buying tickets in bulk and using it as a business, it really does take away from legitimate fans and people that really, really want to see these events.
Yeah, it completely does. And music is supposed to be enjoyed by everyone, and things like this just seem to make it completely impossible for everyone to access these kind of things.
Yeah, no, they really do. It's definitely something that needs to be addressed, and hopefully we'll see a change made, but, you know, nothing's really been done so far, so...
Yes,
I don't know how much hope I've got.
And further in national news, Gary Lineker sparks widespread debate over his comments on the new illegal immigration bill that has been passed by the government and covered much in the media this week. The ex-England captain and face of the Match of the Day has recently come out on social media suggesting that the language used by the government when talking about the new illegal immigration bill is comparable to, in his words, Germany in the 1930s. And these comments have gained traction online with over 230 likes on his tweet. Lineker believes that it's a harsh policy and that more should be done for the protection and representation of immigrants and asylum seekers, but many have come out to criticise his comments on the new immigration bill. For one, the BBC condemned Lineker for his comments, suggesting his recent social media activity is seen to be a breach of their impartiality guidelines. And they also followed this up, he'd be forced to step down as Match of the Day presenter until an issue about his use of social media. But this escalated rather quickly for the BBC and caused a big problem for them out of nowhere. Other BBC sport pundits such as Ian Wright, Alan Shearer and Alex Scott all boycott the Match of the Day this weekend, and players also decided to support Lineker and boycott any interviews from the BBC this weekend. So unfortunately this caused a big problem for the BBC over the weekend. What do you think of the whole situation?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I think it's really, really lovely that all of the presenters actually stood in solidarity with Lineker. But I think it's a super interesting situation that we're seeing unfold. You know, it's not every day that you see an entire show have to be cut down to less than a quarter of its usual runtime. The fact that Match of the Day on Saturday was just 20 minutes of clip played with commentary, and yeah, it brought in 500,000 more viewers than the Match of the Day the week before. I think, though, it is pretty fair to say this was just people's curiosity getting the better of them and sort of wondering how the show was supposed to run with no presenters. The Leicester game, Leicester fans held up signs in support of Lineker. Some of them said, "Gary Lineker for Prime Minister," "Gary, Gary, Gary Lineker, stand up to racism," and "I'm with Gary, migrants welcome." There was quite a few of those, actually. But I do think we really need to look at the high standards that he's expected to meet when... If we have a look at the chairman of the BBC being a known donor to the Conservative Party, and he donated over £400,000 to the Conservatives before securing his role at the BBC, and is currently under investigation for potentially helping the ex-Prime Minister Boris Johnson get an £800,000 loan. But we haven't really seen any criticism by the BBC of their chairman, despite him being openly a supporter of the Tories and not impartial.
And I think you do raise some good points there, but I do think it is a very tough situation. And Lineker is passionate about the subject of asylum seekers, and he should be able to express this in any way that he feels. But at the same time, he is employed by the BBC, and they do have strict rules of impartiality, including that presenters of the BBC should keep away from taking sides on party political issues. That the BBC's highest paid presenter, having earned a reported £1.35 million in... From this perspective, the criticism is somewhat justified, as he does have a role to keep to the BBC's impartiality rules because it must be in his contract somewhere.
Yeah, no, I mean, I do. The BBC do have and always have had very clear rules on what is allowed. I think there's maybe the potential to argue that given that Gary Lineker does only present about football, you know, he's not a politician, he doesn't present a show about politics. And we have seen BBC employees like Andrew Neil, for example, give their opinions on topics such as Brexit all over his own Twitter. So surely you could argue maybe that what Gary Lineker posts on his personal Twitter doesn't have to have any affiliation to the BBC, as it's not being broadcast over their channels.
I do think that Gary Lineker, he should obviously be able to speak in any way that he wants. And like you said, the BBC have other problems with who they employ, who have had similar issues in the past, but the BBC have seemingly done nothing about it. So yeah.
Yeah, I think they're definitely needs to be one rule that's stuck to by all employees at the BBC, regardless of whether they're pro-conservative policy.
Yeah, for sure. But it does seem that this issue has been sorted out this morning, as Kerry and the BBC announced that he will return to Match of the Day this weekend. So it's good to see that they have both come to a mutual understanding and that things can carry on.
Yeah, I think that they've definitely listened to the sort of wider response from the public and, of course, the other presenters. I mean, so many celebrities have come out in support of Gary Lineker, and I think that the BBC have realised that what they've done was, you know, potentially a mistake and caused a lot of backlash. So it's really, really good that's sorted.
Yeah, I agree. And it'll be nice to see Gary back with his team on Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah, definitely. So that's all we've got for you today on these top news stories. Thank you so much for tuning in. We also have a podcast on immigration that we'd love for you to stick around and listen to.
Yeah, thank you very much for listening and have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you so much for sticking around to listen to our podcast on immigration. We've got some really interesting topics lined up, as well as an interview from an expert in political science and associate professor at the University of Reading, Dr. Christoph Arndt.
So, in today's episode, we'll be talking about the language used by the UK media when covering issues of immigration, along with the issues of immigration detention centres, and how the UK government plans to deal with the illegal immigration moving forward. And finally, we'll be talking about the latest immigration issues in Sweden. We hope you enjoy.
As Charlie said, the first topic we're going to delve into on a deeper level is the sorts of language that we see used by the media and how this can potentially influence the attitudes and beliefs of us as the general public, and whether it's fair for the media that we consume to have such political biases. Let's start with The Sun, for example. Now, I'm sure everyone listening will have heard of this newspaper, and probably a lot of you will have read it too. But do you actually know who owns and produces this newspaper? So, The Sun is actually owned by a family called the Murdoch family, which you've probably heard of. But how much do we actually know about them? So, according to Business Insider, the Murdoch family has a net worth of over $17 billion. So this makes them one of the richest families in the entire world. The Murdoch family own a company called News Corp. And if you want to pop onto their website, you can have a look at all of the companies that they actually own. And it does show us that they own more than just that one newspaper in the UK. In fact, the Murdoch family alone have ownership of papers such as The Times, which of course would then include The Sunday Times and Times Radio. They also own TalkSport and Virgin Radio. This is really interesting because there's actually a political theory behind this. So the theory was developed by two men, Herman and Chomsky, and they've named it the propaganda model. So what this is the idea that the mass media serves as a system for the elite to communicate messages to the general public. So if we look at the Murdoch family and take what we know about them, it would be wrong for us to assume that the newspapers such as The Sun present us with an unbiased report on what's going on in the world. This theory, it basically tells us that the Murdoch family are using these media outlets to push their own opinions onto us. So this is really, really interesting when we look at the language that these sorts of papers use when talking about migrants and refugees attempting to reside in the UK. If we take a newspaper such as the Daily Express, we can see that they've had many, many covers that talk about migrants. So some examples of these could be migrant workers flooding Britain, migrants rob young Britons of jobs, workers are fired for being British,
Now, all of these are painting migrants in a relatively bad light. Words like flooding are not particularly positive. And even if we don't pick up this newspaper, glancing at it in the shop is going to imprint these words into our head and potentially cause a bias that we didn't even realise we had.
I think you are right to bring up the propaganda model, especially pointing out the monopoly that the Murdoch family has over some of the most popular UK media outlets, as you've said. And the construction of the news and its language is very pertinent, especially on the topic of immigration, as I feel it's often used as a tool to potentially polarise the electorate, as the media seem to constantly keep the issue at the top of the agenda, whilst often, as you pointed out, using unflattering language to discuss the topic, which definitely has an effect in reinforcing a negative outlook towards immigration for the reader. But I do also feel that sometimes people may bring their own agendas to the media and only engage with media that matches with their own views. Such as with immigration, there are a lot of people in the UK who have strong, hardline views towards immigration, and I suspect they will only engage with these with the newspapers and media that reinforces this agenda.
We've spoken to Dr. Arendt, who has given us an insight into why media outlets use such language and whether it truly affects how welcoming the British public can be towards migrants.
So our first question is going to be about the language and the media. So often in the media, we see harsh language used to describe migrants, words such as flooding, robbing, or as Braverman called them, an invasion. What impact do you think this has on the general public, and how damaging is it to the overall image that the British public has in their heads about migrants and immigration?
I mean, there are sort of various effects. I mean, in a way, like, people care about migration. This is one of the topics that is really polarizing the population, but also political parties. So this sort of wording will reach a certain audience, but not another audience. So it might be part of an agenda setting from the Conservative Party, might not reach Labour or Lib Dem voters. They would use a different language to reach their voters or potential voters. So that might be part of a strategy, but we should also consider that there are people who are just not really so willing to accept further mass migration in most Western European countries, so they will be reached sort of by this sort of language.
Right, so in this next part, I'd like to bring attention to the ongoing issues and moral complications surrounding the use of immigration detention centres in the UK. Immigration detention centres and their use have been at the centre of contention in the UK media for some time, especially bringing attention to the conditions these centres present. Detainees are often held for extended periods of time, with basic human rights being frequently violated, and I feel it is an interesting topic for us to talk about. So one of the most significant moral issues which is often talked about in the media is, of course, the prolonged detention of individuals for often months or even years without any indication of their release, and this can lead to severe psychological effects. And I actually have a personal anecdote from a migrant who had a poor experience with immigration detention from the Berkshire area. Ali is an asylum seeker in the UK from Iran. He has 2 university standard degrees and he can also speak 6 languages. He recently spoke to The Guardian and talks about his awful experience in the Berkshire Hotel, where he was held for over 500 days on just £1 a day, earmarked for essentials. Do you think it's fair for a case to be ongoing for this long when we see such treatment and uncertainty? Ali is just one of 37,000 asylum seekers currently stranded in the UK, and it seems that our system is failing to give these people the opportunities that they deserve. It seems unfair that someone of such ability like Ali to be detained for almost 2 years when surely, with his degrees, he'd be able to contribute to our society and economy positively.
Yeah, I feel like it's really interesting that you've brought that up, actually, because if we have a look at the statistics and we look at our NHS, who I'm sure a lot of you listening at home absolutely appreciate and are really, really grateful for, actually a third of doctors that work for the NHS are employed from abroad, and they're not actually British-born, and a quarter of nurses are also not British-born. So I think that immigration is so, so important to our workforce, and someone like Ali would definitely contribute to our society and economy positively if he was given the opportunity to come and work in the UK.
Yeah, I feel that's definitely correct. Overall, the government are failing the needs of many asylum seekers like Ali, who are genuinely fleeing their home and countries for valid reasons. And that surely that as the UK, as a leading democracy, we should have an obligation to help these asylum seekers a lot more. And I feel stories like this are important because they allow the readers to resonate with the human side of immigration issues, which I feel is very important. easy to support the implementation of hardline immigration policies, but at the end of the day, they are just people with families trying to do the best for themselves, and surely the UK should do its utmost in trying to help these people strive towards a better life.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel it's so important that you've highlighted how we are a leading democracy, and, you know, we do have a responsibility as a very rich nation to look after the people that don't have the same stability that we do. But I suppose it's really hard, and especially for the listeners at home, they probably don't really know what having an influx of immigration would do to our country. And as much as we should be helping them, it's really difficult to draw the line and to know where we should stop and how many people we should allow in. And actually, I feel that if we put ourselves in the positions of these families that are trying to flee, they really are just the same as us, except born into a really unfortunate situation. And I think when we look at immigration, we definitely need to be sensitive and think about the fact that these are people's real lives and they're not just numbers.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like you're definitely right there, for sure.
Right, so leading on from this, I would like to discuss how the UK have proposed to deal with the influx of illegal immigration across the English Channel, such as the Rwanda Plan, what it involves, and perceived positives and negatives. So as I'm sure everyone is aware, Dover is a town in the southeast of England which has been facing an influx of illegal immigrants arriving in small boats for many years now. A reported 45,700 people used this route in 2022 alone to reach the UK, which is an increase of around 60% from the previous year. Now, this has put the UK government under pressure in recent years to come up with a plan to reduce this illegal form of migration across the Channel. And this saw the government announce last year its Rwanda Plan, which is supposed to allow the UK to send some migrants to Rwanda to be processed and given the opportunity to apply to seek for asylum from there. And this is a plan that is supposed to deter people from making the dangerous illegal trip across the Channel to the UK, as they are now at risk of being deported over 4,000 miles away to Rwanda whilst they apply to seek asylum from there. And I think it's a good plan on paper, as it sets out a practical solution to help reduce the burden on UK's border control whilst also being a strong deterrent for future illegal crossings. However, the plan has been criticised by many, such as whether or not it's sustainable, or the potential treatment of migrants who will be sent to the other side of the world, living on a completely different regime and no doubt a different quality of life than that of the UK. And people are questioning whether or not there are more effective or sustainable ways to deal with this issue.
I totally agree with you. I think that on paper, like you said, it seems like it's a really, really good idea. But I think we need to consider the fact that these people are coming here to seek asylum. They've left really dangerous conditions and, you know, most likely come over here in relatively dangerous ways, out of just desperation. And I think to ship them off to the other side of the world whilst they wait to hear back on whether they've been granted asylum or not is just completely just unfair, arguably even inhumane. I mean, they've come here to be safe, and a lot of people that come to the UK, the reason they choose the UK is because they have links to the UK already. And then to be sent to Rwanda is sort of random, actually, and it really would make more sense to accommodate them in the UK whilst they are waiting to hear back the outcome of their application.
Yeah, and I think you've raised some good points there, and it does remain to be seen how effective the Rwanda plan will be, as it hasn't officially started yet. But I do feel like it does show a clear initiative from the UK government and proper steps to address the issue, which we haven't seen in a while, and the population has been putting the government under a lot of pressure to do so. And so this initiative has also recently been picked up by the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, as recent talks of lifetime bans for Channel migrants have been suggested as the next step to deal with immigration problem in Dover. Under new proposed legislation, and just in the past week, the Illegal Immigration Bill, Channel migrants could be prevented from re-entering the UK if they cross the Channel in small boats. And many supporters are suggesting that this is a common sense approach and that the PM is getting a grip on illegal immigration. And a quote from Rishi himself saying, "Make no mistake, if you come here illegally, you will not be able to stay." So it seems that this idea has been gaining traction and support recently and shows yet further initiative to deal with the Channel immigration problem, which so many people in the UK have been putting the government under pressure for. So much of the population will probably be happy about this new proposed law. So overall, I feel the recent initiatives from the government towards immigration have showed significant progress in dealing with the issue, as they are determined to make the only way into the UK safe and legal,
and preventing illegal crossings of the Channel is no doubt highly beneficial for the UK's border control and the safety of these migrants. But sustainability of the proposed Rwanda plan, for example, doesn't seem to be concrete, and I feel when it does finally start rolling out, we may continue to see similar safety and human rights problems. So what more do you think the UK government could do to ensure sustainability and safety for migrants moving forward?
I think it's really interesting to look at the sort of alienation that we put onto these migrants that want to come over. We sort of make it seem like they're completely different from us and, you know, they're not welcome in our country. I think, especially if we look at the Prime Minister, so his grandparents actually moved over to the UK in 1966. And it's really interesting that reportedly his grandmother sold all of her wedding jewellery to fund the move to the UK. And I'm sure for a lot of people listening, to sell your wedding jewellery, I mean, that is really sort of the last step you would want to take, you know, that's sort of a desperate move to make. And so, of course, you know, selling your jewellery, that doesn't equate to risking your life on a small boat, but it does show that actually, as harsh as the Prime Minister is being on people that want to come here illegally, I don't think he's actually taking into account how desperate these people are and how we should treat them really with a bit of humanity. And, you know, for a lot of people, like you said, they think it's common sense and that he's finally getting a grip, but I think it's really, really important that we treat these people with dignity rather than just sending them away.
And yeah, as you say that, it's almost surprising that Rishi has got such a hardline approach to immigration when he has such a personal story with it himself. You know, if it wasn't for immigration, he wouldn't even be in this position that he is today. So I feel like, you know, he should definitely be more grateful, and it's definitely surprising to see how hardline he is going.
Most definitely, I completely agree with you. Following on from that, the UK's new hardline approach to immigration, illegal immigration specifically, it's also really important to look at the softer, I suppose you could call it, approach that they're now taking to legal immigration and how you apply for citizenship and whether or not you'll be granted it. So we thought it was really important to actually take a wider look at Europe as well, not just the UK. It's really interesting to note that Sweden actually for many years allowed the most immigrants per capita into the country out of all the countries in Europe. According to the World Population Review, around 20% of the population in Sweden is actually made up of migrants. So why is it that in April of last year, the Swedish Prime Minister, Magdalena Andersson, came out and released a statement claiming that the integration of immigrants has failed and was fueling gang crime? In 2019, fatal shootings were the highest in Sweden than every other European country, and 90% of these were actually down to organised crime groups. Stockholm alone has around 60 organised crime groups, it's speculated. Sweden has over the last few years been experiencing extremely high levels of violent crime, such as rape and sexually violent crimes, with those numbers also being the highest in Europe.
Really, judging by that Swedish example, it can almost seem justified that the UK is trying to take such a hard line with immigration, because we can see the future effects that having such high levels can have further down the line on the population and the dynamic of the country. And like you said, it's especially surprising to see this happening in Sweden and Scandinavia, who are often seen as the world's leaders in quality of life and for low crime rates.
Definitely. I think it's really scary to look at, actually, like you said. I mean, if a country like Sweden can be experiencing such high crime, you know, the UK does struggle with crime already, especially areas like London. So what is going to happen if we keep allowing immigrants? It's really important to look at that and see how, in what direction we could be heading potentially, and why we're not headed in that direction actually. So we have spoken to Dr. Aaron again, who specialises in Scandinavian politics, and we're hoping that he can give us some insight as to why the integration of migrants has failed so hugely in Sweden and why this is so different to the UK.
I would say the Swedish case is a particular one, because this country had like almost uncontrolled immigration for many years, especially since 2015. With the refugee crisis, but even before, like the former Prime Minister Reinfeldt said, "Open your hearts," so invited basically the whole world, and there was almost no real criteria for migrating to Sweden, and this created this problem that at some point the number of migrants was so high that it was just impossible to integrate all of them. And then you get the segregation on the labor market, also on the housing market. You get like almost sort of no-go areas with daily shootings, and then the problems are reinforcing and reinforcing. So there was just a sort of naive thought that you can integrate everybody into the country, and this did not work. That it's not only the current government who just took over and now is sort of forced to compete or not to compete, to work on that issue. And yeah, I would also say the welfare state plays also a role here. You can see with all Nordic countries, the welfare state becomes pretty attractive for a certain type of migrant. And this further contributes to like segregation on the labor market. If you have like a high reservation wage, then some migrants won't find work because their skills are not enough or not sufficient, and then they remain outside of the labor market, and then all the side effects, crime, and yeah, being sort of an outsider and so on. The UK has not experienced this problem to this degree as Sweden. The UK welfare state is criticized by some, but we would also say, since it's not that generous, it does not attract that sort of migrant. I mean, the UK has parts of the problems that Sweden has, especially in the bigger cities, London, Manchester, Birmingham, also knife crimes, shootings, but it's not at the level as Sweden. So there's like political mistakes made in the past to now sort of account for the problems that Sweden is sort of is facing with migration, especially from non-Western countries.
As you would have heard, we mentioned at the end there that Sweden has actually begun to introduce sort of a set of criteria that have to be met in order for individuals to be granted citizenship and work permits and stuff like that. So this is actually not too dissimilar from the UK's new points-based immigration system. So this is completely changing the way that the immigration system is going to work in the UK. And rather than it being somewhat a lucky dip on whether an individual that's applied for citizenship will get it, there's actually a real process now that's going to be followed. And so it's a points-based system. As I'm sure you'll all know, before we left the EU, there was a freedom of movement, so you could reside in any EU country without having to apply for residency, and that was completely okay. And Priti Patel, the ex-Home Secretary, announced that this new immigration system would allow the brightest and the best to enter the country, and it would unleash the country's full potential. So I'm going to explain a bit about how the system works. What you need is an immigrant would need 70 points to be granted citizenship. So the points can come in different forms, and there's three that you need to have, otherwise you won't be able to gain citizenship. The first three are you need an approved job, you need the appropriate skills to complete that job, and you need to be able to speak English. So that all together adds up to 50 points. 20 points is for the job, 20 is for the skills, and it's 10 points to be able to speak English. And then you still need to find 20 more points somewhere to get up to the 70. So you can get 20 points if you earn more than £25,600 a year. So I think when we look at this, actually, as much as it seems like there's a bit more freedom in how you gain the points, really what you need to be doing if you're applying for residency here is you need an approved job, the skills that you would need to complete the job well, you need to be able to speak English, and you need to earn more than £25,600 every year. And that will then give you the right to citizenship and residency in the UK. And to be fair, I think it's a pretty good system. I mean, it's great that the people coming over will have jobs already approved. And obviously being able to speak English is going to make it so much easier for them to integrate into society. Because, of course, we are an English-speaking nation and we're not particularly multilingual, British-born individuals, that is. But yeah, I'd say overall it sounds like a really good idea.
Spoken again to Dr. Arndt, who can hopefully give us some insight as to how these new laws will work and whether they're going to yield the positive results that we've been promised.
And our last question. So Sweden decided to implement a set of requirements that have to be met in order for migrants to achieve residency, such as having lived in Sweden for 3 years or earning over a certain threshold. This is similar to the new United Kingdom's point-based immigration system. Do you feel as though this will yield positive results in Sweden, and why? And additionally, how do you feel about this new points-based immigration system going ahead in the UK?
I mean, this is an empirical question, because I would say the Swedish rules are still quite lenient compared to other Nordic countries, especially Denmark, where you have like requirements of 8 or 10 years to get full residency, to get Danish citizenship, and so on. So the rules are still lenient or liberal, and both the new Swedish rules and the UK point system, yeah, they remind us of other mostly Anglo-Saxon immigration policies like New Zealand, Canada, US. They all have some form of point system or criteria that are equivalent to a point system. So obviously you want skilled people, you want people speaking English, and so you want all those factors that make it easy to integrate those people to the labor market and to the country. And therefore, I don't think these rules are very like stringent or so or restrictive, because they're quite lenient, and they sort of match other Anglo-Saxon countries. The Swedish one, this will be an empirical question, how well this works, whether they get some form of control over this sort of migration to Sweden, or whether this is still the Nordic country that is experiencing all these problems, not only because, but also because they are sort of more liberal than the other neighbor countries who just have stricter rules. And I know from Denmark, because I live there, that Danish politicians often refer to Sweden, and we don't want the Swedish situation, or how they call it. So we don't want that things escalate as happened in Sweden. And if Sweden is still the most liberal country, it might still get a problem with attracting the wrong type of migrant that, say, Denmark or Norway don't want.
I'd be really interested to know what you think, Charlie.
Yeah, I do think it is a good initiative going forward, with especially dealing with, of course, immigration in the UK. As we've seen, Australia as well have a very similar rubric, and it's been seen to work very well over there, so why can't we implement that over here? And I feel like with the strict rules and points that you have to get in order to now get citizenship, if that is put together with a better dealing with the crossing of the English Channel, I feel like it would just work overall very well for the migrants and for the English economy.
Yeah, definitely. I think this is a really, really nice structure to have, and I think it actually is really positive, and it's sort of heading us in the right direction for the future of immigration, and hopefully it's going to really turn out to be a great scheme, and we'll be able to unleash the country's full potential, as the ex-Home Secretary did say.
So I feel like this is a great way to move forward for the government in dealing with immigration issues. And this brings us to a nice end to our podcast.
Yeah, definitely. We're so glad you decided to stay and listen to our podcast on immigration. And we hope you've learnt something, or at least found it interesting.
Yeah, we hope you have a lovely rest of your day.